Hi, y'all. This is Kristen Chenoweth.
Hi, I'm Gloria Stefan.
This is Sarah Bareilles.
Hi, I'm Patti LuPone.
This is Lin-Manuel Miranda. You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Hello, all theater lovers, both out and proud and on the DL, and welcome to Broadway Breakdown, a podcast discussing the history and legacy of American theater's most exclusive address, Broadway. We are taking a break from our series, A Little Sondheim Music, for a very special episode. First off, with me, friend of the pod, alum of the pod, Mr. Jimmy Larkin. Hello, Jimmy. How are you?
Good. How are you, Matt?
I'm wonderful, Jimmy. Thank you for asking. Excited as I am to have you here, Jimmy, you are not the headline of this episode.
Oh, geez.
But like, would you say that's fair?
Yeah, that's absolutely fair. The person that we're interviewing is far more iconic.
Far more iconic.
Iconic. I like that word.
Our interviewee today is, okay, oh boy, hon. I need to take a breath here because this individual has just done so much, and it's going to take all my breath support to get even a third of it out. This person has worked on Broadway, TV, film. He's been a music director, music supervisor, orchestrator, arranger. He's a composer. He's a vocal coach, vocal supervisor. He's worked on the original Broadway productions of Starlight Express, Chess, Sunset Boulevard, Aida, for which he has a Grammy Award, Bombay Dreams, for which he has a Tony nomination. That's just to name a few. TV, Cinderella with Brandy and Whitney Houston, for which he has an Emmy nomination. Annie, for which he has an Emmy. South Pacific, for
yes,
which he has an Emmy nomination. Movies, he did Chicago, which he has a Grammy for, yes, fantastic. Dreamgirls, Across the Universe, Connie and motherfucking Carla.
Oh my God. Oh, you, Jesus.
If you thought we weren't talking about that, you are on the wrong podcast, sir.
Oh man, I can't believe it. Yeah, cool.
Nine, as well as the original Lion King and Mulan, not these remakes, the original OGs. Please welcome to the pod, Mr. Paul Bogave.
Oh my God!
Were you just winded?
Everything.
That?
Well,
I didn't do everything. Yeah. You have so much more.
No, you didn't. You didn't do everything. Yeah. You didn't mention
Did we even get to Tarzan?
Oh, I forgot to mention
Tarzan. Oh yeah.
Emperor's New Groove.
Because Tarzan.
You got it right.
First question, right off the bat.
Yeah.
While conducting Chess in 1988, you had a, some would say, front row seat to Judy Kuhn's Nobody's Side 8 times a week. Were you ever close to pissing yourself just watching her do that number? Because I would have been.
You know what? I conducting Chess was amazing because you get through one great song and you go, oh shit, I got after Where I Want to Be, I've got someone else's story coming up. Oh, Heaven Help My Heart, which I love. But Nobody on Nobody's Side is so cool to conduct. And, you know, we did a Carnegie Hall concert after the show closed, a benefit that was unbelievable, with the original cast.
Oh, that's exceptional.
An augmented orchestra. Yeah. Yeah.
I can only imagine that place was on fire that night. Like the entire audience.
Went nuts. Standing ovation after the first act. And of course, the second act. And we picked the best. You know, there were several different endings to the show, but we picked the one that had the reprise of Anthem with the chorus. It was amazing. And David Carroll, who you may know from Chess and Grand Hotel and Phil Kasnov and Judy Kuhn, amazing.
So, Paul, how did you come into this line of work of music direction, arrangement, orchestration? Because it's not something that I feel like most people wake up one day and go, that's what I want. It's more sort of something that they kind of experience throughout their career. And then like,
yeah, well, I always played keyboards and I played in rock bands and I went to Cornell and I left Cornell the sophomore year to come to New York. And I decided that I was going to go to Juilliard for music, which I did. And also at the same time, I acted. I played Claude in Hair in a touring. It was one of the end of the national touring companies. And I did a couple other shows, but then I took a conducting course at Juilliard and I said, ah, shit, that's what I want to do. But I started as an audition pianist. And the first show that I got to be a rehearsal pianist was Woman of the Year with Lauren Bacall.
Okay.
Who tried to fix me up with her daughter, which was cool.
There are worse people to be set up with than Betty Bacall's daughter.
Yeah, well, Betty Bacall's daughter wasn't having any of showbiz, I have to tell you. She was like, yeah, and Betty told me, she said, well, you know, she's a nurse. You know, she says, I save lives. You act, I save lives, you know. And Bacall was cool. She was very down to earth.
Any Bacall stories that come to mind immediately?
Yeah.
Well, give us one.
Oh, yeah. And I can
I'm
swear.
Hungry for Great. Them.
Oh, okay. So the conductor, who was named Donald Pippin, and the assistant conductor said, okay, you have to work with Betty because you're young and you can take it. So so I said, okay. So I worked with her. And I would every day after lunch, I would do an hour session with her. And every day she would go in her limo to have a voice lesson, right?
In her limo. She had a voice lesson in her limo.
No. They would take her. She would eat lunch at the limo. Okay. They would take her. That's I'm sure people have had voice lessons in their limo. Anyway, it would take her three blocks from the rehearsal studio to a voice teacher. And she would come back, you know, having had this lesson and work with me. And one day she came back and she actually made a tone. Now, you're a singer, so you know what the difference between, you know, and, oh shit, I got 10% left. I may have to recharge, but.
Okay.
Anyway. So she comes back. And she was like, I said, Betty, you made a tone. She goes, nah. And I said, yeah, you actually made a tone. I said, did you have a good lesson? And she said, I don't have any goddamn lesson. I said, what did you do? She went, I went to the fucking dentist. And I went, I said, did you get gas? She goes, yeah. And I got Novocaine too. And I went, that's it. It's like relaxed your jaw. And she was funny. She goes, wow, do you think I could have that every night? And it was the one time I actually heard a tone come out of her.
the one time a tone came out of Lauren Bacall's throat.
She goes, I didn't make a tone.
Jimmy, do you have a question you want to bring up first?
Well, no, so you come from more so a rock background or rock and musical theater, and then you kind of combine
both.
Them.
That's right.
See, because all your work is the thing that I find so interesting about all your credits is it's really a cool crossover of like taking things out of their time period and adding either rock music, pop music, you know, R&B to these shows that are set in like the late 1800s and stuff, you know, and that's a really specific crossover, but it sounds like it makes so much sense for who you are, you know.
Well, hey, it's one of those things, when it works, it's great. When it doesn't, it's not, it's pretty bad. But I think it's come, especially now, and you know, look at movie scores. You've got period movies like Marie Antoinette that have rock scores in them. And that was not accepted years ago. I love mixing styles if it works. Everything emanates from the story, from storytelling. And I don't care what kind of pyrotechnics or sets or whatever you have, if you don't have the spine of a good story, which is the problem of Spider-Man, which did not have a really good story, you can't put anything on it and expect the show to be interesting. You just can't. So I love the mixture and, you know, I love the passion of rock and what you can get from it. In some ways, rock is closer to opera, you know, and as you know, rock operas and Superstar. I think Andrew Lloyd Webber is similar because he does have a rock and classic background, and he was able to, combine that. That's one of his strengths.
Well, you kind of came into Broadway then at the right time, because your beginning as a Broadway music director was sort of at the height of these British imports with Andrew Lloyd Webber and Trevor Nunn. So your sensibility really matched that. Starlight Express, Chess, Aspects of Love, lot of Nunn in your life. You and Trevor seem to get along pretty well. Would you say that that's accurate?
Trevor is one of my best friends and has been for years.
It would just be interesting with all these Trevor Nunn shows. It's like, oh, we hate each other, but we respect the hell out of each other. So we just work all the time.
No
catty drama like that. That's a shame.
Well, no, the only thing was, is I turned down Gone with the Wind. He asked me to kind of come in and doctor the score. And I said, I don't know if you heard about it. It was a tremendous flop in London.
Yes.
And I said, Trevor, there's like 1.5 songs that I can work with. And I said, the rest of it. And he was like, I think we've saved a lifelong friendship. You know, you shouldn't work on it in that case. I had to be honest with him. Listen, I was honest with the producers of Spider-Man when they asked me to come in, and they said, what did you, I saw it. And they said, what did you think of it? I said, do you really want to know? I said, it's the worst thing I've ever seen in my life, including Legs Diamond.
You said that.
The show that turned the Mark Hellinger into a church, Spider-Man, was worse than that.
Or, on a level. And I didn't see, I actually turned down Carrie for Chess. I had been asked to do Carrie first, but I wanted to do Chess. And so, but I never saw that. So I don't know. There's a number of flops that I've missed.
Carrie is sort of we're gonna go all over the map with this, because I know I speak for both myself and Jimmy. Like, you've done so much that I care so much about, and my brain definitely goes like A to Z to L to J. So we'll like flash forward to 2005 and go back to 1987. It's just how it's gonna go. The interesting thing about the music arrangements with Cinderella, with the Brandy Cinderella, is it's one of the few times I can really think of where these terms that always just sort of seem so contrasting actually work. So when someone says, like, can you make this golden age score sound new and modern, but also keep it tied to its golden age roots, but like really embrace the different kinds of singers, but also like tie it all together. It's these words that sometimes when you say them out loud, feel like they're nothing. But Cinderella, or the way that Cinderella was done, like, that was actually it. It's these grand terms. When you think about it, you're like, that's actually what that movie did with that music. And Carrie, to bring it back to Carrie for a second, Carrie, I feel like, was trying to do something similar, where it's like a rock opera and it's modern, but it still has pop music and it's teeny boppy, but it's also, and it's, for all the stuff I love about it, it's just so, for lack of a better term, bipolar. And they were trying to kind of do sort of a Natasha Pierre Great Comet situation with all these contrasting genres, make it one big tapestry, and they just weren't able to do it.
Impossible for a plain yellow pumpkin to become a golden carrot. Impossible for a plain country pumpkin and a prince to join in marriage. And
so because I opened the door, and because it's going to take up 80% of this video / podcast, and I know Jimmy has a million questions, as do I, as do all of our followers. Cinderella, how did that come about in your life?
It came from Craig Zaden and Neil Maron. Mm-hmm. And I knew them for years in New York. Craig had been involved with the Public Theater. And then they went out and they produced Footloose, and they were in Whitney was going to play Cinderella originally. Mm-hmm. And then she was like, I'm too old, forget it. And they called me. I think I had just, I'd just done Sunset Boulevard in Australia with Hugh Jackman.
Oh.
Yeah. So it's where I met Hugh Jackman and have remain friends for years. Anyway, I don't want to tangent from that. So they asked me to come out and do Cinderella. And I first worked with Brandy in New York, and I was kind of familiar. She was Moesha. She had was minor, minor star.
Yeah. She was upcoming.
Yeah, exactly. Well, she's 17, I think. And I started to work with her in New York and then went out to California to work on it. But the arrangements, a guy named Marty Erskine was doing arrangements. And we also hired a jazz arranger to alter the chords for the famous ballad, Do I Love You, you know, Because You're Beautiful, mm-hmm. just to, you know, slightly alter them. And that's a very, very tricky thing to do that, because when you do the kind of hybrid thing where you add altered chords to Rodgers and Hammerstein, it can actually sound like Vegas arrangements. Do you know what I mean? Because mm-hmm. that's what they do. You know, when a singer sings a show tune, sometimes they will put you know, jazz chords on it, and you just go, "Ugh, it's not working."
Yeah, you get like flashbacks of Sammy Davis at the Copa or something like.
Yeah, no, yeah, Robert Goulet, that kind of stuff.
Yeah, and like some of the funny disco Sondheim stuff.
The disco Sondheim. I'm not talking about Jimmy. Yeah, I love Ethel Merman's disco album.
Oh, we love.
Oh my God, she did a disco album.
Did she ever? There's also a Sweeney Todd disco album. It's marvelous.
Oh, hey, Sweeney Todd, I think. That's my favorite score
of all time.
West Side Story, mm-hmm. love, but I think Sweeney Todd, definitely favorite Sondheim, I think.
I mean, yeah. That's a very good choice to have. So with Cinderella, so I meant to ask this earlier. A lot of people who listen to this podcast understand who a music director is. Not many people might understand what a music supervisor is, especially with film and TV. Could you expand on that?
Yeah,
to Cinderella.
The term music supervisor in film, when you see that credit, is not the same as it is with theater. That has to do with music supervisor will choose, you know, songs for a soundtrack, and it's not quite the same thing. They also would not allow, the Directors Guild would not allow the credit of director as music director. So I was always either conducted by or music, I think it's like music supervised and conducted by.
Got it. So on something like Cinderella, when they say music supervisor, it's not the actual term that you would for a film. Is that what you would do? No. What you did on Connie and Carla, those like actual music? Surrounds?
Connie and Carla, that was a whole different thing.
I told you it was going to come up. We're talking about Toni Collette belting on screen. That's so rare. Man,
she was good, right?
Oh, she's amazing. She's Queenie. She's Queenie, and she was a blonde.
Well, Connie and Carla was probably the easiest, and I mean easiest thing I've ever done, because okay, you're asked to make 25. Bad, like medleys, like, you know, the first place, it's really funny, takes place in an airport lounge, right?
Mm-hmm. They go from like Oklahoma to Cats or something.
Singing. Oh, yeah. So and the thing, it's not hard. Doing parody is kind of like, you know, things like a score to Spamalot, it's not hard to make a bad Andrew Lloyd Webber song. What's hard is to write a show where you care about people and, you know, like a Wicked, like score that isn't making fun of a genre. Mm. Well, Connie and Carla, you just had to be bad. It's not hard to be bad.
What does it say about me that I thought those medleys were legitimately wonderful? Am I?
Thank you.
Do I have?
They were legitimately wonderful in their tackiness. Yeah. I think.
And their audacity to just go from one to
right.
Jimmy,
oh, yeah.
Jimmy, have you seen Connie and Carla?
I'm so disappointed to say no, I have not.
Are you aware of it? Do you know what it is?
No, I mean, I've heard of it, but like, yeah. I really don't know it. And I'm sure from hearing everything you're saying, I'm sure I would die.
Oh, it's amazing. It's a cult movie. It's essentially Some Like It Hot.
It's a cult movie. Yeah.
Some Like It Hot meets like The Birdcage, where Nia Vardalos and Toni Collette are Broadway obsessed women in the middle of, you know, the Midwest, I guess. and they witness a mob hit. Chicago. Yeah, they witness a mob hit and they go into hiding and they go to LA because they think that's the last place the mob will look for them, because the mob only knows that they like theater. And they're like, there's no theater in LA. We'll go to LA and they'll never know to find us. And they end up posing as drag queens, and their whole shtick is like, no, this is before Drag Race. So like their whole shtick is, we sing live and no other drag queens in LA sing live, and they sing all Broadway show
tunes. I've seen videos from this for sure.
Yes. And Toni Collette, it was before I knew Toni Collette had done Wild Party. I fell into the LaCusa Wild Party in high school. And so I was listening to her sing. I'm like, no way is that Toni Collette. And then my friend gave me Wild Party. I was like, that's Toni Collette.
She's good. But you know what we did with that is they sang, I almost everything, I lowered a step that, you know, that they would have sung normally as women, because they had to sound like, it was weird. They had to sound like they were men trying to sound like women. Mm-hmm. So they were women playing what people thought were men playing women. And
very Victor Victoria, very that.
It was Victor Victoria. You remember, and I get to work with Debbie Reynolds.
Because they want to start a Debbie Reynolds dinner theater. Jimmy, you need to watch this movie.
Is there a scene where they do Maybe This Time on like a small stage? I've definitely seen videos from it. I don't know if I've ever watched the movie in its entirety, but it sounds like something I would eat up.
I've never done drag, but if I were to do drag, my very first number would be Bernadette Peters' Falling in Love with Love. And I think Jimmy can co-sign on that with me.
For sure.
I want to bring it back to Cinderella.
One of the stepsisters just died. Natalie. Yeah,
I know, so Natalie. Funny.
Yeah.
She really was one of the most iconic parts of that movie for me. Like her comedy in that. And that's another kind of thing. Like she took comedy that is like very much like more modern, I guess it was 90s beats. Period piece, you know, and like that blew my mind as a kid. You know, I was like, she's funny in a late 90s sense, but she's working with a script that's set in the time period of whatever time period it was, you know.
Exactly. Yeah. I watched Stepsisters Lament the other day with that laugh that she does, man.
Oh, yeah.
My favorite part.
Yeah.
Well, so I was in preparation for this, because my introduction to Cinderella started with, or at least in terms of the Rodgers and Hammerstein Cinderella, I should say, started with the 97 Brandy. And then I was made aware of Leslie Ann Warren first, and then eventually Julie Andrews. Mm-hmm. And so in preparation for today, I went back and sort of listened to those other versions to get a sense of sort of what you guys did with the music. Because again, I speak for Jimmy on this as well. I don't know if you are as aware of this, Paul, that version of Cinderella has been very iconic for our generation of theater kids. We just adore it. And the music is really a huge part of that, the way that the music was adapted.
Right.
And listening to previous iterations, it's interesting to hear like how Impossible and Stepsisters Lament kind of, you can hear the bones in those original versions. And what you guys do are not necessarily like totally remolding it, but rather just like giving it I don't want to call it a fresh coat of paint, because that implies that the old versions are like moldy by any means. They're not. There's just a sense of excitement and storytelling to them.
Well, that's the motor. We used to use that term, you know, that can be the groove, but it's a percussive thing that really, and that Impossible, that was a perfect example.
Yeah, the way you built Impossible is really exceptional. Sorry to cut you off, but I'm not sorry, because I keep wanting to talk. But the Impossible,
or the Sweet of Sounds, even.
Oh, Sweet of Sounds, yeah. I want
to R&B.
Yeah.
Sweet of Sounds, right.
Yeah, Sweet of Sounds R&B, even in my own little corner, has a lot of that. But Impossible, when you watch the original version and the subsequent Leslie Ann Warren version, while they're so pleasant, there's something about the last section that always kind of feels abrupt, like it doesn't totally build to it. It sort of plateaus. And you guys were able to create, as you said, a motor to it. So it really built that ending. Like, I always get chills when Brandy gets into the carriage and the music goes bum, bum, and she's kissing when you go. Great. It just builds to this really gorgeous, truly musical theater finish, but still tied to R&B and hip hop and all those different kinds of genres. Exactly what I said earlier, these like nothing terms that people always say when they don't necessarily aren't able to give specifics that somehow apply so perfectly to that adaptation of Cinderella.
I don't know. I know you guys want to. Maybe it's the time to tell the Whitney story. Should I tell it?
Yes. Well, I mean,
any Whitney story.
Any Whitney story. Plenty of people have asked me for a Whitney story. So you're sweeping up.
Okay.
Many
this is
questions.
If you look up my name in Whitney Houston, I think it's still on the internet. But when I wrote this article, the Whitney Forever Whitney fan club people, they loved hearing this, and you'll hear why, because it is very complimentary to her as a person and as an artist. She was, we were doing the song, There's Music in You, you know, the finale,
of course. Mm-hmm.
It's quite rangy and high notes. And the worst thing that can happen in the studio is when the board breaks, you know, the computers break. We were in Capitol Records, and Whitney was, I think she was trying to get off whatever she was on at the time. And, you know, and that's worse than if you're really wrecked, you know, she was in a withdrawal period, I think. So she was already a little on edge. And I think it bothered her that she didn't have the high notes that she did. That was bothering her. So she wasn't in a great mood to begin with. And then the board freezes, right? And it's not getting fixed, and it's getting 10 minutes, and she's in the studio. And I remember saying, hey, I'm putting my shoes on. I'm jangling my car keys, meaning I'm out of here, right? And I did something that if I had thought about it, it had time to think about it, I don't think I would have done. I opened the door to go into the big studio out from the control room. And I just said, hey, Whitney, you know, I've been having trouble with my son. He's 6 months old. I can't get him to burp. You're such a good mother. And I wasn't lying. I mean, it was true. I see you with Bobby, you know, her daughter. Mm-hmm. And I said, can you help me, you know? And her personality flipped like 180 degrees, just complete. She was, oh, honey, what you got to do is you got to put him on your shoulder and walk him around the apartment and get him to that. That'll get him to burp. She goes on with 20 minutes of childcare. And all of a sudden they fix the thing. So I'd gotten her to stay, you know, and not leave. She goes, okay, let's go. She's singing like I haven't heard her. It, her whole personality trance.
I have chills.
It's unbelievable what happened. And I always tell that, you know, when I'm doing lectures or theater classes, and you have to know psychologically how important that is. And you guys both are performers and singers. So you know what, how freeing that if you get out of yourself, which is what happened. She, you know, she became a in teaching me, she loved it. I could tell that she loved to you know, teach Brandy, and I think I knew that, so I took the chance of diverting her attention, and it altered her personality. So what was still there was able to come out.
And love them.
But they're okay. So everyone who's listening to this episode, and we talked about this before we started recording, there is obviously a very iconic video in regards to the making of Cinderella. You know it's a meme. You told us your sons told you a few years ago, Dad, you're
right,
a meme.
Right.
It is the iconic, and I talk about it in an earlier episode. I actually have an episode dedicated to this in terms of its title, which is when Whitney and Brandy are rehearsing Impossible with you. You're in the video. Right. And Brandy's going down the octave, and Whitney shouts, "Why are you down there?" And then goes up the octave, "Possible."
Yeah, right. No, she was meant to be. She first did it. You first hear "Impossible." I think what she did, I was trying to say, she did it in the right octave, and then she did it down an octave. I said, maybe she's hearing me, because, you know, guys'
voices. Oh, right. And you were singing along too at the time.
Right. Guys' voices are, an octave apart with girls. So I thought that maybe that was it. But that was very, you know, Whitney being the mentor.
When that moment happened, did you know that you were sitting in the middle of history with that line, or was it?
No, of course not. No.
Did you know there are shirts made that say, "Why are you down there?" Right?
No, really?
Yes.
Oh my God, that's great.
That is also part of the legacy of Cinderella, is "Why are you down there?" And it's also the editing, because it's clearly like she doesn't pop up the octave like immediately after she says it. Obviously, the way that it's edited, she does it, but it's just perfect editing. And it highlights it so well. And you're a part of it. You're in the, some might say you're in the room where it happens.
Brandy's right over your shoulders in that video.
Oh man, that was so exciting. It was so exciting.
Now, Paul, I have one question for you about Cinderella is, as far as the sound of the piece goes, was that decided, like adding the R&B flair and some of the other sounds, was that decided before you knew who was going to be singing it? Or was that?
Yes.
Did you base that around Whitney's sound and Brandy's sound?
No. It was decided because of Whitney's participation in the show. I think it was decided.
Right.
It wasn't written for Brandy, but it was definitely decided that this would be a redo of the score. And something we're not talking about that I always found so amazing, and so that I'm so proud to be a part of. This was the first interracial, iconic
huge
fairy tale. This was white bread all the time. If you watch the Julie Andrews and Leslie Ann Warren, and the fact that you've got the king, Victor Garber, the queen, Whoopi Goldberg, and they give birth to Paolo Montalban, Filipina. It was great, and it was a great atmosphere around the filming when we filmed at Universal, because the chorus is Latino, it's white, it's Asian, everything, and black, and it was so exciting because that wasn't around. We had intermittent things like Audra McDonald in Carousel,
of course.
Which, if you ever, I don't know whether that's on tape, but I saw that was
anybody amazing. Who listens to this podcast, I want to let it be known, I did not bring up the 94 Carousel. Paul did, because Carousel is my favorite musical, and the 94 production, it's my favorite musical, and the 94 production is, in my opinion, the greatest production that it'll ever have. And I talk I talk about it almost too much, especially on this podcast. The only other musical I talk about at excess that my listeners are tired of is Smile. My listeners are like, stop bringing up Carousel, stop bringing up Smile. But
yeah, was that Marvin Hamlisch?
Marvin Hamlisch, and Howard Ashman with Paul Giamatti. Same season that you did Starlight Express. But that's just how my brain works. But I want the listeners to know, I did not bring up Carousel, Paul did. But yes, I love that production. And
that was because of Audra.
Yeah, and Taye Diggs was in the ensemble, and Shirley Verrett was.
I didn't know that.
And to bring it back, Taye Diggs, I read, was also up for the prince in Cinderella.
Yes, he was.
Oh, wow. Yeah. I don't know. No, I did not know that.
I was going to say, you had people. So something that I really love about that Cinderella, and also with the Annie, is that something that I talked about with the live musicals of the last couple of years was that I felt that a lot of those live musicals, while I really appreciated their efforts, they were taking things that were not necessarily meant for the medium of television with commercial breaks, and it didn't always quite fit. And they would put in people who, you know, while very talented, musical theater wasn't really what they did, you know, like with Rent or with Sound of Music. And with Cinderella and with Annie, you had people who maybe weren't, like Brandy was not, you know, a veteran of musical theater, but the material was crafted around her, so she was able to shine as best she could. And Annie with Kathy Bates doing what she did. And I just thought that those are sort of, in my opinion, the like benchmarks of that, of taking something and bringing in people who maybe aren't known for this genre or this, you know, style of performing, and really allowing them to succeed as best they can by tailoring everything to them, that which also then in turn lets the material succeed.
The things that I've done, I love actors who sing. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's the acting for me comes first. So it's been great to work with people like Kathy Bates, who had never done a musical before.
She had not done a musical before that?
No. I don't even know that she had sung. No, I don't know. She'd never done a musical. And I went over to her house, and everybody, Rob Marshall and Craig Zaden, were like waiting to hear what I, you know, because they didn't know what she was going to sound like. Mm-hmm. They must have known something that maybe John Kander heard her once, but she could, they wouldn't have hired her without knowing that she could do it. And it was great because I said, look, she said, I'm a character actress. I don't sing as myself. I said, can you do any imitations? And she said, oh yeah, Ethel Merman. And she did this thing for me. Like, you know, it was funny. It went softly, the song. And I said, okay. So we decided that so she could sing like Easy Street, you know, that kind of old fashioned Sophie Tucker style. Mm-hmm. You know, Sophie Tucker, who she was, like that.
According to Roxy, Sophie Tucker will shit she knows when she sees that her name is billed below.
I remember that. Sophie Tucker, right.
We'll talk about that movie as well.
And I said, okay, so we made Miss Hannigan kind of like Ethel Mertz and Lucy, right? Who had been in vaudeville. And I said, okay, Kathy was like, you know, being a really great actress, she bit that, man. She loved that. And I said, okay, you're this frustrated, you were in vaudeville, you didn't make it, and you're stuck in this fucking orphanage with the girls. She goes, got it. And see, that's how she was able to get out of herself, out of her self-consciousness about singing.
With Annie and with Cinderella, there are two sequences that I wanted to talk to you about in regards to the collaboration of putting it on screen, which is you can talk about both or either one. Cinderella, it's the princess giving a ball, and Annie, it's NYC, which are these two songs that for both versions were kind of restructured, reformatted in their own ways. And part of that is, you know, how it's told in the story. Part of it is who's singing it, what's being sung. Prince is Giving a Ball obviously like had extra material written. I know there's an oral history.
It's kind of an incomplete song.
Watch the Julie Andrews version and you're like, there's something missing. And it doesn't really build in a way. It's basically the same thing over and over again. But I wanted to ask you sort of the process of sort of working those songs musically with the director, with the choreographer, with the screenwriter of
that was a collaboration, both songs between Rob Marshall and David Crane, his dance arranger, and they and picking the right orchestrator. Michael Starobin did who you know from Sunday in the Park and many other things. And we always picked him for the more flamboyant kind of production numbers. And that was modeled after Danny Kaye. For Jason Alexander, that was tailored like a crazy Danny Kaye song. So they had a real idea, you know, concept. And NYC, I'm talking about Annie. With Annie, I had more, I think, more say or more creativity in terms of how we did the orchestrations and the music, because Rob Marshall is such a specific director. I could have a 3-minute conversation with him, say, these are my thoughts. And I would know from the way he was doing the story, how we should go about the music. And I told him what I wanted to use. I wanted to use Americana. Aaron Copland is one of my favorite composers, classical composers. And since you know Bernstein, I know you know well, he is a very, pupil of the Aaron Copland score. It's the chords. And I wanted Annie, the original Broadway orchestrations are, I don't say this pejoratively, but cartoony. There's something, you know, it sounds sometimes like the Salvation Army, and it was specific. That's what they wanted. So I described them that, and we did, what we were doing was a realistic Depression musical. That's what was the concept of Annie. And I said, okay, I want to add these Copland chords, like to maybe, and we redid Tomorrow, as you know, with a kind of different ending on it. And I didn't want it to sound like that kind of 70s. There was like a rock beat to it that had dated by then.
Yeah.
If you know what I mean.
Tomorrow originally opens with like a guitar, like do, 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 do. Right. And you
right. That a little motor thing. Yeah.
Yeah.
Or it's a horn sometimes too. Right.
Yeah,
no, that. Yeah, there was
and you guys made it a lot more pensive and like a little sad the way that Tomorrow starts. It's not like saccharine. It's slightly melancholic, which I really love. I also think what I love about the TV Annie, and I have a whole episode about that one as well. If you ever, Paul, want to go back and just feel good about yourself, there's a whole episode about.
I am really. That's one of the things I'm most proud of. I think it's great.
You won an Emmy for it.
It's the Annie.
Yeah. But it was, you know, and it's also the thing that really propelled Rob into because he directed and choreographed them.
Yes,
that was his first.
I thought it was such a smart choice to lower the keys for Alicia Morton, because she clearly has the range to sing the songs in the Andrea McArdle keys. You can hear it with that F she hits, and I Think I'm Gonna Like It Here, which is very iconic. But lowering the keys allowed the songs, like Maybe, to really be heard and understood in a way for film, which I really appreciated. And there was such a purity about how she sung them. So I wanted to ask you also, working with kids in something like Annie, in a professional setting where they have to, especially with something where Annie kind of going into this movie, you already had the general prejudice going against it of people hear Annie and they think, oh, 9 little girls screaming their head off and being cute
and
precious.
I think I lowered It's a Hard Knock Life. I don't think it's as high.
That key is ridiculous. The way
the original key is very mean.
The original key?
The original key is very mean of Hard Knock Life. Yeah.
Nails, you know, stuck through your eyes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You guys definitely lowered it for that one.
You ready for another story?
Yes, please.
Okay. Studio story. All right. You said working with kids. So they were good. And I liked those kids in Annie. They were good. You know, and we rehearsed shows like a Broadway show. You go into rehearsal, like you're rehearsing the play. And then we did a reading, you know, for everybody, and it was first time they heard Kathy Bates sing. It was great. Anyway, we get in Capitol Records in the studio, and I don't know if you've done much recording as a singer, but when you get into the studio, it gets very technical, and you're worrying about, you know, technical things and pitch, and sometimes the acting goes for a while, right? Mm-hmm. You forget what you're, well, they were doing It's a Hard Knock Life, and I just was like, it was boring. It was not what it, you know, the guts and then all the drama. And I just, man, I went after them, and I said, God damn it. This is, and I'm glad I could swear on this. So fucking boring. If you do this like this, when this comes on ABC, I'm going to switch the channel to Wheel of Fortune. That's how fucking boring you are. And I was like, just get them, you know, riled up and mad. So what I forgot is all their parents were in the control room. All of them, all their parents. And after they do the take, and it was good after that screaming and insulting them, the door opens and I could feel this presence. And it was like July or something. Is that a name of?
Yeah. One of the orphans.
Yeah. And it was her father. Her father was about 6'7" and 250 pounds, huge. And I get this like tap on my shoulder and I look up and he goes, you know, we're all in there, you know, meaning the parents. And I said, oh, and he goes, I just want to tell you something. It was like this. We love the way you work with our children.
Any Audra stories with Annie that come to mind?
I knew Audra.
Well, you'd seen her do Mr. Snow and you said, I must work with her. I'm assuming.
Yeah, well, you know, she was the first Aida in the workshop.
She was supposed to, I did not know that. That yes, would have been,
Jimmy, that's amazing.
Still going to be, was it still
first
going to be the same sound that it was going to be?
Well, no, and that's really why, although she, you know, she sings beautifully, but Elton felt that her voice wasn't quite right for, you know, wasn't that it was operatic. It was just, I think, you know, the way it's placed and the way it was sounding with the score that it wasn't quite right. Of course, she sang beautifully and she acted it brilliantly, but Heather Headley was it, you know, when we found her. Yeah.
She, how did you guys find Heather for Aida?
Oh, she was in Lion King.
Okay.
And when I saw opening night of Lion King, I was like, oh, you know, that's, we've got to get her. I mean, we had a few people, we did three workshops. So we had Audra, we had the second one, Simone, Nina Simone's daughter, ended up playing the part on Broadway later. She was the second one. And then a girl named Jennifer Lee Warren was the third workshop. Mm-hmm. And then we got Heather. And we were talking about, you said, oh, Audra's
stories with Annie.
And Annie.
Yes.
Yeah.
And you just reminded me of a question I have in regards to Sunset, but Audra stories with Annie first, and then I'll get to
Well, yeah, questions. It was a little, the only thing that I had with her was, it got a little operatic in the head voice, and I tend to, you know, like tone it down. Then when we had the premiere at the New Amsterdam, they showed it at the New Amsterdam Theater, and I was talking to Charles Strauss afterwards, and he loved the best compliment. He said, I never thought the score could sound like that. And I was like, wow. He really got into, you know, the Copland harmonies and stuff. Anyway, so he says that. And then he goes, wow, I didn't know Grace was an opera singer. I went, oh.
Well, it's also so funny because you have Anne Rankin in the first one where, like, since when is she a dancer, you know?
Yeah. Right.
And then
you
have Audra and you're like, since when is Grace this beautiful lyric soprano? But also, I'm curious, whose idea was it to add that Tomorrow reprise?
Oh, I was asked to, I don't know whether, I don't know who it was, whether it was Rob or whether it was the producers, but that, I put that together. I combined
part of the movie.
No, oh, it is?
Oh, it's gorgeous, yeah.
It's, I posted it on my page the other day, it really resonated.
They wanted a reprise, but I think it was my idea to combine the two songs because I harmonically could do that and interweave it. I'm really glad you like that.
I think it's one of the most, I think a lot of people would agree, it's one of the most iconic parts of the movie.
Just thinking about tomorrow clears away the cobwebs and the sorrow till there's none. day that's gray and lonely, you just stick out your chin and grin and say.
I love doing stuff like that, you know, combining. I did that in Aida. There's a song called Easiest Life.
Yeah, of course.
You know? And when I got the demo, that was not even, it was all I have to do. It's like in 4/4, really slow. Forget how much I love you. It was kind of a lament. And the show had all these ballads. It was like, oh man, you can't have all these ballads. So the arrangement is a combination of a song called Dance of the Robe. Yeah. And what else did I? Oh, Attend the Tale of Sweeney. Yeah, there's some of that in there. Right. I don't know.
When you say tomorrow.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
When you say tomorrow, what were you combining it with?
Maybe. Yeah.
Oh, duh.
Yeah. Well, because normally in the stage show, the stage show, what happens is Annie comes out and she sings a reprise of Maybe, and it sort of trails off in the middle. And yes, Paul very wisely put Tomorrow on the Maybe reprise.
And the music combines. I can't, listen to it again to see what I did, but nothing to fear.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Well, and even something as, I think I'm going to like it here, is structurally exactly the same it is in the stage show. There's just little tweaks to it that give it, as you said, that motor. The way that Alicia does, I know I'm going to like it here. It's just so fulfilling and so satisfying in a way that the original stage show, the way it was in the 70s, as someone who did not see it, but...
Yeah, I didn't see it either.
Annie is a musical that is close to my family because my grandfather was an entertainment lawyer, and his clients worked in theater. So Martin Charnin was a client, Jerry Bock was a client. He'd seen a lot of these things, and we talked about Annie because I went to the opening of the last revival with him. And I said to him, I was like, I forgot like how sardonic this show is. He's like, oh, the original was tongue in cheek the entire time. It was very smart ass. And when you listen to the orchestrations of the original, as you said, it's like very cartoony because it's commenting on the style of music. Yes. And you guys definitely went much more wholehearted, which gives it this great excitement, which again,
you know what else? I used a Gershwin because of the period, because of the 30s period. And that's in NYC.
You can hear that on the Star to Be.
Yeah,
for sure.
Yeah. That's a lot of Gershwin.
That was Andrew McArdle, right? Wasn't she a Star to Be in that?
She sure was.
Yeah.
Genius.
Oh, yeah. You know, that she's the cameo. Yeah.
And I mean, this is a very technical thing that I don't even know if you can say for sure, but it's something that I've always thought every time I listen to it on the soundtrack. Her final note on the It's NYC, it sounds like that's live on the soundstage. That it was in front of the cameras, not in the studio, because it's just, and it makes me, I question it to this day, and I don't know if you can say for sure if that is or not.
I don't know. I mean, we did do that. We recorded everything, but most of the things that we did live that we ended up using were the beginning few words of songs, so you don't get that kind of bump from dialogue to soundtrack. Yeah. We definitely did that with
Cinderella.
You
can definitely hear that in Cinderella. And it's wonderful. I think that's why it works so well, because Cinderella also, Jimmy, I don't know if you noticed this when you rewatched it on Disney Plus recently, I did, a lot, there's some like ADR with the dialogue as well, so it kind of flows out of sound, and it works because when they go into pre-recorded vocals, it's not jarring because your ear's already used to it.
That's right. Yeah.
Specifically Bernadette's What Is It Now? That is definitely ADR, and I love it very much, but that's just me. That's me showing off. The name on everybody's lips is gonna be Roxy. The lady raking in the chips is gonna be Roxy. I'm gonna do you have to go through a similar approach for someone like, say, Renee Zellweger in Chicago, who, you know, goes into this project not thinking she's a musical theater performer? Like, how do you approach you know, for lack of a better term, like movie stars who have to come into this or land any of, they know nothing about.
Any of those nine ladies too.
Oh yeah, the nine women.
You take what well, you get the right keys, number one.
Right.
So Nicole Kidman, we got we'll get back to Renee Zellweger. I'm thinking of Penelope Cruz. Mm-hmm. Did the miss. I recorded her. She was the original part that she would have gotten was the Unusual Way, Nicole Kidman.
And really?
I recorded that. Then Rob had her dance and she had this wonderful dance training. And I flew to Spain because she was doing a Vicky Barcelona there and recorded her doing Call to the Vatican. Mm-hmm. And then she, of course, got that part. But Renee did not audition. We auditioned a lot of people for for Roxy. Toni Collette, who kind of fell in between the two parts. Mm-hmm. You can understand that. She was neither a perfect Roxy or Velma. Oh, a lot of people, Marissa Tomei. But Renee kind of sang in Rob's ear, you know. And look, Roxy, I guess like Sally Bowles in the purest sense, is not a great singer. She's a wannabe. Right. So you can, as you've seen the people who've gone on Broadway, not very often, not great right. singers, but it works. So she didn't have that, you know, onus on it. Velma has got to sing a little belt. Mm-hmm. So Renee, I just worked and worked with her on that, using that kind of 20s, that kind of 20s twang and doing stuff, exercises. And she came in, she had three notes. I remember going, all that jazz. And then one day, that jazz, she got that, you know, place in her voice and was able to do it. I thought Renee was great in Chicago.
Oh, absolutely.
I think she was great.
Well, Chicago's, you know, a phenomenal movie in general. I love her performance. And I mean, I'm a huge Renee fan, starting with Jerry Maguire up until, you know, present day. But I mean, yeah, there's something about her Roxy vocally speaking. You talk about how, you know, similar to Sally Bowles. It does remind me in a way of Natasha Richardson's Sally.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Oh yeah. Oh yeah.
That's not about the singing, right?
Yeah. Where it's, but it's still musical. It's still very musical. So you're not thinking like, oh, realistically, you know, she's not a singer, so it's clunky. Like it still flows on a musical theater level, but it's not that polish that some other singers might have. That
that's more exciting sometimes. I feel like
absolutely
because it's true. It's Natasha Richardson is a perfect example. And there's, I don't know, there's a limit. When some people aren't musical, they're people with great voices who aren't musical, and then there are people with not good voices who are musical, and you are able to, you know, that's something that almost can't be taught. Renee is musical, and you know, she felt that she could dance, and you know, that was very workable. The thing, Catherine didn't have the high notes when she started, but we were able to, again, use that twangy thing that they did in the 20s because they didn't have microphones, you know, and they had to project like that. And we got her voice like that.
You just had to talk to her about burping a baby and then the notes came out. Catherine did it.
Be Italian, take a chance and try to steal a fiery kiss.
Someone like Fergie, who has, you know, has this really, like, you know, majestic voice, but maybe wasn't given the opportunity in her career as a pop singer to do so. Was that something that you had to bring out of her for Be Italian, or was that something that she came in with already?
I mean, I have to tell you, Fergie at the time, it's one of the best instruments that I worked with. And that includes Barbara Streisand and Jennifer Hudson. And she was able to build, you know, what we worked on, actually, I always like to work on other stuff with people because, you know, like we worked on Jacques Brel and stuff with Marion Cotillard and Daniel Day-Lewis. I said, you know, Man of La Mancha and Fergie, I said, and you'd be this great Aldonza. She was able to belt the entire song. She was amazing. And she, I thought she was very good. I thought Be Italian was great.
I mean, I don't want to speak for Be Italian's
one of the best in the movie.
I was about to say, I don't want to speak for the community, but I feel like whatever anyone's thoughts on the movie might be, it's generally considered the one of the best, if not the best number in that film.
Are you ready for another recording story with Be Italian?
I'm ready for any story you give me at any moment, at any time, Paul. After the Audra McDonald and Aida tea, literally anything here on out, I'm like wide open for.
Okay. Graphic. You said it. I don't know who's going to see
it. And
this,
I meant it. I said what I said, and I meant what I meant.
I said to Fergie, because look, you know, the part she's playing Italian whore on the beach. So I'm going to give some direction that they, you know, but I was, before saying it, I had a feeling that she would be fine with any kind of imagery that I gave her. Mm-hmm. And I said, do you mind if she get, tell me anything. Now, to her credit, here she's coming in as a pop star with Daniel Day-Lewis and, you know, and Sophia Loren. Oh, and Judi Dench, these high powered actors. So she was great because she said, I want you to work with me, give me any acting direction that you want. So she'd already told me that. And then I said, look, I might get a little graphic here. And she go, oh, that's fine. So Be Italian has that last note that goes on for 16 bars. Mm-hmm. At last, right? Is that the word?
At last, yeah. Become your last. It's your last.
Become your last. Yeah. Become your last. Yeah. And with that big play out under it. And I thought, okay, when you're holding a note or sustaining a note, you better have something going on in your head, subtext, I think, other than just opening your mouth and you know, singing a note. So when Fergie and I were working on that, look, you got this 16 bar note. So I'm saying, yeah, you know, okay, so for four bars, you're telling them you got to be fierce when you're having sex and you got to love it. And I said, okay, and the third, you're eating pussy. I said, right. She said, oh yeah, I can do that. And,
that is funny.
Like, I can do that. And I said, so I gave her all these, like, you know, some graphic other, just hey, this is like name dropping time. So I tell Hugh Jackman that. He said, you really said that to her? I said, yeah. He said, well, that's good direction. I said, we get in the studio. And now look, Craigie's used to the studio, but it was my whole point is the same thing. You get in the studio and you can get really technical and keep thinking, oh, you know, it's my pitch. Like, so, and I'm sitting next to Rob Marshall. We're doing this in London, and she sings the note at last, and it's pretty good. It wasn't actually, the pitch wasn't perfect, but Rob said, oh, we can fix that, you know, with the auto tune. I said, yeah, but I don't know, there's something. I said, can I go in there? And he said, yeah. I said, hey, you remember? Remember when we did like every four bars, you know, and the eating pussy part, and you know, I the different thoughts. Oh, yeah, I forgot that. See, you know, you forget that when you go in the studio. She does it with the thoughts. The note, first of all, the pitch is perfect, but the note had this spin and interest. And Rob was like, "What happened?" I said, "It's all subtext and thought." And I'll tell you something, that once when you have people who have trouble with a note and they get you get their mind off the technical stuff and the what they're saying and what they're expressing, 10 out of 10 times it comes out better technically than trying to it always is.
Well, they get out of their own way and they allow
that's
it
right
to happen. Yeah.
Yeah, and it's not like saying, you know, tell somebody to relax. That anybody can say that. It's like, okay, what are you replacing your nerves with? What's on your mind that has to do with the story that's going to make you express yourself better and sing better? Mm. And that, man, that worked.
Question in regards to Dreamgirls, where I feel like you might have had sort of the opposite problem, where you have these three amazing singers with this amazing music, where you sometimes have to say, now you got to actually have to scale back a bit and not let the voice come out so much.
Well, with Jennifer, you know, it was very, very green, you know, at that point. She had been a runner-up on American Idol and sung on cruise ships. And Fantasia. You remember Fantasia?
Of course.
Remember. Oh, who was great in The Color Purple, by the way.
Yes, she was.
Great. Fantasia was the choice of Bill Condon.
For Effie?
Oh, yeah. And I saw the screen test. I didn't think vocally that she was as right, you know, in the end, that I wouldn't have picked her. But David Geffen did not want to. He said, no, I'm not going to do the movie. You got to find me another Effie. And Jennifer had already auditioned. And the first day that I came on the job, my job was to get her into the movie because there was nobody else. And Bill Condon said, they won't let us do Fantasia. And I called him about 15 minutes after work. I said, she's going to get it. You watch. And what the thing with her was, she went, she was going to do Jennifer Holliday's version of I'm Telling You. And I said, none of that. This is you. You're not going to copy her riffs. So we worked out everything that worked for her. And it took her a while. She got the song like well into shooting. I remember that. There were a lot of different takes. And we worked on the, what's that song? Love You, I Do. Love You, I Do. We worked out all the riffs on that. That was kind of a Burt Bacharach thing type song. She was great.
Heavy or Dreamgirls or Move, where it's a little more kind of tighter harmonies and fewer chances to really vocally show off, that's got to be its own kind of issues. Whereas say like Kathy Bates or Glenn Close, you have to say like, well, you know, go bolder, go bigger, try bigger artistic acting brushstrokes to get the voice out. Someone like Beyonce, who is, you know, this amazing singer, then has to kind of scale back for nightclubs.
They had to be that's what we worked on. They had to be in ensembles. They had to be the Supremes. Mm-hmm. And these are people, well, not that you know, again, Jennifer was not famous, but she was already, you know, she's a solo star. Mm-hmm. And Anika Nani Rose, great voice and a really great actress. Really great chops. Really good. And I knew her from New York, so I knew her already. That was getting them to be an ensemble. Beyonce's great. She's so wonderful to work with.
That's wonderful to hear.
She used to kiss me on the cheek after every rehearsal.
You still washed your face afterwards, Paul?
No, I didn't. Okay, I haven't washed my face.
I was about to say, this interview's over years. If you washed that cheek afterwards.
I was dying. I mean, so like I couldn't believe her. I said, you're really well brought up. She said, yeah, I know.
So this will translate for Jimmy. He's got a question for you.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, what I have to ask, because you did everything with Aida when I was looking at your credits arranging, conducting,
from the beginning, music
supervising. Yeah. So there was a lot of talks about Beyonce doing an Aida movie. Did you ever hear about that?
I heard about that.
And what happened to that?
That just didn't happen. I don't know where that went away. Side, that would have been good.
That would have been.
I think she'd be fierce, and I think be an acting challenge to her. I thought she was really good in Dreamgirls, and you know that's a hard part, Dina. I think it's not the part that shines like Effie. It's a difficult part. Yeah,
it's a part that people mistake a lot because. I mean, the movie, they allow Beyonce to have Listen, which does, show up
and
do vocally. Yeah, yeah, yeah. But in the original stage show, the whole point is how Dina's voice is a different kind of sound, more clean and commercial. And I think a lot of people mistake that for not showy, or maybe the singer is not as good. But there's a lot of meat still to that role, and having that contrast with Effie's voice that I think.
Yeah, I mean, I give points to people who are in what are called difficult parts that are not showy parts, and I thought she did. I thought she did great.
Yeah, I'm still waiting for. I don't care who's in it. I don't care if it's Beyonce or who, but I'm still waiting for that Aida movie because I think that music would translate really well. You know, it's such
Before. That was I got that from Tim Rice because I had done the original Lion King demos.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they were gonna, if you can believe this, not because they were bad songs, but Tim Rice, who I knew from Chess, called me, said they're gonna throw out these songs that Elton and I wrote. And the first song he gave me was Can You Feel the Love Tonight, and I Just Can't Wait to Be King. And then later on I did an arrangement of Circle of Light. I was like, what? I said, sounds like a huge hit. And he said, I know, but they don't see how it can fit in a movie about Africa. It was called King of the Jungle at that time. And so I did these arrangements with African instruments and I thought were, okay, nothing big deal. And all of a sudden they're, oh, wow, we can do, we love the songs now. So, anyway, so that worked. And then when they were doing Aida, Tim said, would you come in? And Elton said, look, I don't know anything about writing a musical. I'm a songwriter. And I just was given these demos. And some of them are, like I said, easy as life. Some of them almost are unrecognizable once we got through with them. And some of them are quite like they were, I think Like Father, Like Son was similar to the demo, but that was a great creative project. And I got a lot of, Elton was great. He was like, I'm going to let you alone. I love that.
Yeah. I mean, if someone wants to understand the depth of your work on that, all they have to do is listen to the demo of Strongest Suit and then Sherry Renee Scott's Strongest Suit, where you don't change a note. It's just how you structured the song and you let it build in a way that's so musical theater and brilliant. Was Sherry a part of it from the beginning?
Absolutely. She was the one constant, and Adam came in when Heather came in, Adam Pascal. But Sherry was from the beginning. And the only other person that we considered, had Sherry not done it, was Sada Ramirez.
For sure.
She gave a great audition. I remember that.
Her Lady of the Lake is still one of like those iconic, taking a role that's like not much there and just milking it for everything it's worth. Her voice at that time was just so exceptional. And I can only imagine what 99, 2000 Sada Ramirez could have done with Strongest Suit.
I fell on my back. Yeah, Sherry was amazing. A lot of fun.
Seeing Aida on Broadway, that was the first, because I was 9, I think, when I saw it. It opened right before my 10th birthday. And that was the first time I ever saw someone sing the way that Sherry Renee Scott sang in that, like, live in front of my face.
Oh, yeah.
Because I, at that point, my Broadway experiences were rather limited. Coming in over the bridge, I saw maybe like one or two shows a year, and my shows were being curated by my family, who all like, you know, Golden Age stuff and 70s
yeah,
stuff,
yeah, yeah.
Which is, I love them still to this day. But yeah, seeing Sherry Renee Scott doing Strongest Suit, that was a formative show for me.
Did they like, did your family like Aida? Did they?
The we ended up seeing it because my school would see two Broadway shows a year, like the whole student body's families like paid to see some like gala performance. So that was the year of Aida. The following year was Mamma Mia. And my family, we really liked Aida. Mamma Mia is another story because I saw it in London first and I hated it because I didn't understand like singing along to the score that people were going to do. Because I didn't know ABBA really well. And then when you saw it a year later on Broadway, I was prepared for it. So I liked it a lot more.
Yeah, I liked it. I got, it was like, Fred M used to say that when he came to see Starlight Express. And I said, what you think? He goes, hey, man, I really liked it. It's like, park your brains at the door. You know?
He knew.
It was like, park your brains at the door and you'll enjoy it. That's what I said. Mamma Mia was silly. I thought it was fun.
Well, I always say Mamma Mia is the kind of silly show I like because it does all the work for you. Like Mamma Mia is very smart about how silly it is. So you like when you can sort of let your brain at ease because it doesn't, you don't catch up on so many things. The show's really good at overcoming a lot of that. Starlight Express, Sunset, Chess, Aspects of Love, like obviously these British imports. Is there anything about music directing when you have a score that's already kind of been implanted on the pop culture consciousness?
Oh,
is there any kind of, well, Chess especially, where there's already like a legacy leading up to it.
Sure. Well, with Sunset, that was a different production.
Right.
And it really, you know, they ended up closing it in London for 3 weeks and implementing all the changes that we did in LA. Especially the opening number. But when I went to see it in London, I'm glad I saw it because I thought a lot of it was too slow. And that was one thing that I decided. I said, I'm not going to, I don't agree with the tempos. So that helped it. I think it, you know, enlivened it a little. It was very heavy. And, you know, your question was about what do you do when you've got a score. A show, well, we did. Chess was different because it was a different version of the show. That it was a book musical, whereas it had been very much sung through in London.
Mm-hmm.
So it was changed, and we had a new song, "Someone Else's Story," but a lot of it, you know, you don't. The arrangement of "Nobody Unknown Beside," of course, that was. You're not gonna mess with that.
Jimmy, I don't know if you know the story about how Judy Kuhn came to be a part of Chess. Do you know the story, Jimmy? Do you know the story, Paul?
Well, I was at the auditions.
Well, so. How she got to the audition, I mean.
Tell me what you know.
So it's Judy had done a 4-performance flop called Rags the same season as Les Mis.
Well, I saw it, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And Rags closed. When Rags closed, it got nominated for Best Musical like a year later. And they offered Rags the chance to do a number from the show. And so Judy Kuhn, she did One Day More with the Les Mis cast and sang the title song of Rags, like right before it. And apparently after the telecast, Trevor Nunn came up to her because he was in the middle of casting Chess. He was like, Judy, you belt? And she's like, belt. And he was like, well, I'm casting Chess. Like, can you come in for Florence? And she was like, yeah, sure, whatever. So that's what got her the audition. I don't think it was on her radar. She wasn't on his radar, but that performance is what did it. Do you remember?
Right, because he knew her as Cosette and didn't know. Yeah, yeah.
I mean,
right.
what a great instrument and varied instrument that she has. Mm-hmm. And she's so relaxed. She does a lot of Alexander technique. I think I said, what is, you just like stand there? And she said, yeah, I did a lot of that voice that comes out of her.
Do you recall amazing. Her? Do you recall her audition for Chess?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
Can you tell me about it? Because I want
And I'll tell you why I went for her. I said, you know, she has a certain vulnerability and folky quality that I think works well. When I was talking to Benny and Bjorn and Tim Rice, I said, that's because we all, you know, you often very, the people behind the desk are polled saying, okay, who is your favorite? And there were only, as I recall, four, and one was Laurie Beachman, who was great. Oh yeah. Oh yeah. And I felt, and I love Laurie Beachman. I've worked with her and I thought she was great, but I, for some reason, thought Judy would fit the part as it and better. And I liked her vocally. I can't remember the other two. They weren't two well-known actresses, but I do remember saying, yeah, she's my choice. And of course, Benny and Bjorn and Trevor wanted to be, Trevor wanted her also, but you know, Trevor is a very, he's very strong, mm-hmm. which a director has to be, and forth, but he is not unwilling to hear people's opinions and be swayed.
What I love about Judy Kuhn's voice and her, especially as a singing actress, because again, she's like top of the tier for me, is that the instrument is there. She is very musical. The notes always come out so fantastically, but it's never at the expense of character or expression.
No.
There's always an attitude. If it has to be angry, you can hear the anger. There are times where it can be a little rough where it's never, the voice is always in control in the sense that you know it's healthy, but it's never polished in the sense that it becomes a product. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Oh, of course. Also, you know, she's got really strong acting chops. I wish you could have seen her. Golda was just great.
Can you talk about that West End Fiddler? Because that was very recent.
That's very recent. And I was thrilled when, as you said, you know, Trevor and I have been good friends and we were having dinner in New York a couple of years ago. And I said, what's going on? What are you doing? He was very cryptic. He goes, well, I have two words for you. Klezmer and the Chocolate Factory. And I went, Klezmer and the Chocolate. I said, you're going to do Fiddler on the Roof, aren't you? He goes, yes. And I was like, I'm there. I always wanted to do Fiddler. He goes, really? You want to come over and do that? I said, yeah. And he said, oh, well, I think they've got somebody. Then about a month later, he called. He goes, you know what? You're doing it. I talked to David Babani. I was like, great. And the whole concept, when he said Klezmer, we were going to do, years ago, a TV movie like Annie and South Pacific that I did of Fiddler on the Roof, with Craig Zaden doing it. It got canceled because of problems in Eastern Europe filming. Victor Garber was going to play Tevye.
Oh.
But at the time I said, you know how I want to do it? I want to strip it down musically, similar to Chicago, which I made the band smaller than Broadway in many instances. So we did it with eight pieces and I had a great guy named Jason, who's would orchestrate things for the Chocolate Factory. And I did it with, conducted from a keyboard, and I had a cello, and I had five. Trevor wanted as many of the orchestra on stage. So during the wedding, we had five people go down and play from, you know, mm-hmm. trumpet, trombone, accordion. And it sounded big when it had to, but it still sounded really klezmer, and all the critics remarked on that, which was great. They got it. And a terrific actor named Andy Nyman, played Tevye, not like a Mostel, but a great actor first, very good singer, and he and Judy got along really well. But the thing that was so great about it, and so great about Trevor, is that the acting values, it was so real. It wasn't sticky, and it can be, you know, played for. It was still funny, but it was so real, and it was done environmentally. So, you know, you, especially in the Chocolate Factory, you felt like you were in an Anatevka. It was out in the audience, you know. And then when we moved it to the West End, they reconfigured the theater. So there was a kind of a walkway, runway that bisected the entire orchestra floor. And they built the set way out from the proscenium. And you really felt like you were in the village. So the whole realism thing worked great. And we got the Olivier.
So as we come to a close, I want to come back to the work that originally made me reach out to you, that got Jimmy on board, that's going to get all the people to continue to listen to this. We're coming back to Cinderella, Paul. I'd say sorry, but I'm not sorry.
Yeah.
I had one person who asked about the added songs, the added Roger songs. They wanted to know the origins of that, sort of how Sweetest Sounds and Falling in Love with Love and Music in You came to be. Do you know sort of the origins of how those songs came into the project?
Because the score, it's kind of incomplete. You know, like Princess Giving a Ball is a part of a song that was augmented. But we just wanted more music, and it worked with it. I thought it worked very well. I'm not a big fan of catalog musicals and jukebox musicals because they often feel like they've shoehorned songs. One of the great thing about Mamma Mia is they make fun of that. You know, like all of that is so that it's like a campy thing to you know, break into some, you know, Dancing Queen or something, and that works. But it's when they, you know, taking a bunch of songs that weren't written for something, and I think they were very careful about it, the producers. And The Sweetest Sounds, it was great to introduce you know, a romantic thing with Paolo when she doesn't know, you know, it's like the Prince and the Pauper story. You don't know who he is. And Falling in Love with Love was perfect for Bernadette, and that arrangement, you know, that
it worked
again
perfectly.
Another motor song. Yeah, another song with a motor, different kind of motor attached to it.
It's usually a waltz, that song, right?
Yeah, it's written in three. Yeah.
And
this was three again. I like doing, I did, that's what I did that in Aida, where you take a 4/4 song and you combine it with three, and it gives a certain kind of energy to it. And it's like triplets against the 4/4.
Were there any songs in nine that were sort of up in the air about keeping or cutting? Because that was a question that somebody had about nine that I mentioned earlier, was there were a lot of songs from the stage production that weren't in the movie. Were there any songs that were
the
sort
bells,
of
the bells of
of Saint Sebastian that was up in the air?
I don't think it was up in the air. It was cut. Oh, I know. You know, I Can't Make This Movie.
Mm-hmm.
There was that one. I had to do an arrangement of that for Daniel. That I think that they were on the fence of not doing that.
Interesting. They were thinking about cutting that.
I'm not totally sure, but I remember having to do a couple versions of that.
Interesting.
Tailored for him. Yeah.
With your work as a composer, an arranger, orchestrator, music director, are there any songs you look back on, if you were to like listen to it now and go like, I did that, like that is tops. Like I know that I pointed out, you know, Impossible and Cinderella, and we talked about NYC with Annie. Have you looked back and gone like, you know what, with some distance, I can look back and say my work here is really damn good?
Well, Aida. I mean, Elton gave me, man, Elton, again, his credit, he is not, he's self-effacing about his music. And he said, when he heard at the last workshop, the version of Easy as Life, it was interesting because I did that with the second workshop. It sometimes things don't work, mm-hmm. you know, and I had the middle part of Easy as Life. I didn't get it right in my version. And Elton was like, you know what, let's go back to the old version, the slow ballad. And then I called him up when I was in rehearsal. I said, you know, it's really not working like that. It's kind of, she's coming off kind of self-pitying and slow. And then he was like, he said, well, I'm going to be at the workshops. He goes, I said, can I try another shot at the version of Easy Life? He said, we did it at the workshop. And he came down, the cast was, you know, we were the very few people, Michael Eisner and Tom Schumacher, and it was not open to the public. Mm. And they thought that he was coming down from the row, four rows above me. And they said, it looked like he was going to come down and hit you, like he was mad. Mm. And he came down and they're like, I could see their faces like, and he comes down and he fucking high fives me. Right. Then at the meeting, I can't believe this. He said, you know, Paul took a middling. That's what he said about his song. He took a middling song and made it into a showstopper. And that's when you go, fuck, I did. Yeah.
I'm proud of that.
Yeah. And listen, you know, Jim, when you said I had forgotten about that song, that little moment in Annie of the reprise of Tomorrow.
Isn't that a beautiful thing that it can have such an impact too?
Yeah, that I had no idea that you know, people said they liked it, but you know, to hear somebody years later go, oh, it's my favorite thing in the movie, that means a lot to me, you know? Yeah.
Well, and it's moments like that too, where it's like stuff like that or the entire score of Cinderella that I'm like, I just wish that they could license these productions to be done live. Like, I wish that they're, I don't even know if this could be in the works somehow, but I wish that people could license the Brandy Cinderella, the way it's written, to perform on stage, you know, with all the new songs and the arrangements. And
wow. Shit. Yeah. I didn't see the Broadway revival with mm-hmm. Laura Osnes and Santino. Yeah. I didn't see that. So I don't know what they used of our, whether they used Sweetest, I have no idea, but I don't think they used any of those arrangements.
It was very much the original, the Les Amis.
Right. And also, you know, again, we had a modern, you know, pop people in the show. So we wanted it to have that hybrid quality.
Yeah.
But eventually, I mean, they even got Kiki Palmer to be Cinderella after Laura, who uh-huh. I think is very similar. Like, she's really funny and sweet. And she has a similar quality to Brandy, just like a younger version. So I would have loved to see her doing that version of it, but I don't know.
What it did was it sort of retracted back to, sorry to cut you off, Jimmy. Retracted is not the right word. It regressed back to very old school musical theater sounds, which again, as I said, like, I don't have any issues with that. I think it's a beautiful sound, but when you have already heard it done with, as you said, Paul, like that motor from the Brandy Cinderella one, where it just has this excitement and this spark to it, something sort of feels like it's missing. What they did keep, and all productions of Cinderella now have it, so you can truly take credit for this, all productions of Cinderella Forever now have There Is Music in You. Not the Whitney riff-tastic version. It's a little more classical, but it's the same structure. It has Music in You into uh-huh. Allegro, finishing with Music in You. So right, all versions right, do right. that, including the last revival. But it's much more the original Julie Andrews Impossible. They don't do Falling in Love with Love, obviously. They don't do Sweetest Sounds. They do a kind of version of Prince's Giving a Ball, but again, there's a humor to the Jason Alexander version that's also very character based. I love the, and I know Fred Ebb did new lyrics for it, but I love the rearranged lyrics that include the stepsisters and the stepmother in Prince's Giving a Ball, because it is so character based and it makes the lyrics all the funnier, because you hear the original lyrics, which are pretty cute, which is, you know, I wish that he'd proposed to me. Why shouldn't he propose? The reworked version has the stepsister saying, I wish he'd proposed to me. I wish that he'd proposed to me. And then Bernadette going, just leave the hair and clothes to me. And it's just a, you know, check mark out.
Yeah, that's a good number.
Even just the addition of like, that's the two songs. That's Your Majesties, which to me, like, I don't know if many people even know the song Your Majesties from Rodgers and Hammerstein Cinderella. It's just kind of like it happens, whatever. But the way that you guys combined those two, it made it so much more exciting and used some of the music from both songs in the dance break. And
That was David Crane, and the dance arranger, and Rob Marshall. They're great at that stuff.
Yeah. Took two songs that kind of just happened in the musical, aren't anything huge, and just combined them to make a show-stopping number.
Yeah. But it's amazing that all of you, you know, all these different people were able to sort of come up with this cohesive unit. I think, you know, this is as good a time as any to call it a close. Where can people find you if they would like to find you? How can they reach you? I mean, I know how they can, because I reached you, but I want you to divulge the ways that you would prefer.
They can reach me anywhere. I don't care about, give out my number, give out my email. I don't give a shit.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, so you have a website, pablogave.com.
Oh, yeah, yes. I have a website. You can reach me on that. That gets to me somehow. But I have two, the email, I use the old email address at AOL for people who want to coach or work with me. Uh-huh. And I don't know, my cell number. I don't care.
If you want Paul's cell number, you're gonna have to DM me on Instagram.
At this time, I do. I work with people on Zoom. You know, I'm prefer one-on-one, but you know, live. But I've had great success working with people all over the world on Zoom. So if anybody wants to work, contact me and I'll do it.
Lovely, Jimmy.
That includes you too.
Well, okay. I know Jimmy and I will probably take you up on that.
I'd love to hear. Yeah, I'd love to hear you. What I'm looking at you and say, oh God, this guy is castable.
Think I'm castable. I think that I would make a phenomenal fairy godmother, but only if it's the Whitney version of There Is Music in You.
Well, if you got the chops to do that, you can hit the bull on Impossible. You got the part. But,
thank you. Jimmy, tell people where they can find you. Most people who've come to this episode know, but say it anyway, babe.
My personal Instagram, Jimmy Larkin, nothing exciting, no frills. And then my other Instagram account, Let's Hear It for the Choice, which is more fun and musical theatery.
Yes, has become an institution of the musical theater community. You can find me on Instagram at Matt Koplik. Again, usual spelling. If you like the podcast, give us 5 stars, give us a nice little review. It always helps the algorithm. If you don't like the podcast, you can write me a terrible review, but still give it 5 stars. And I will.
If you don't like the podcast, fuck off.
Listen, people are entitled to their opinions. They're entitled to be, but fuck off.
They're entitled to be wrong,
Paul. That's their choice. Anyway, thank you so much for listening, guys. And I think we're going to close out. We close out every episode with a nice diva. And I think what better one to close out with than Brandy and Whitney together hitting those beautiful notes in Impossible.
Oh, yeah.
Yes. Thank you so much.
Why are you down there?
Why are you down there? Jimmy, say it for us.
Why are you down there?
Please do that.
Please do that. Why are you down there? All right. Bye, everybody.
The world is full of zanies and fools who don't believe in sensible rules and won't believe what sensible people say. And because these daft and do-it idols keep building up impossible hopes, impossible things are happening.
They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com. If you love Broadway gossip, you are not going to want to miss any episode of this podcast, Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway. Plenty of dramas unfold on stage, but the best dramas unfold backstage. And there were no bigger dramas than behind the scenes of Sunset Boulevard.
So you were being crucified over here, but yeah. Not there.
No. No, because I was turning in a performance that would get standing ovations. Excuse me.
So check out my podcast, Singular Sensation, for all the juicy and gory details of Sunset Boulevard.